From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. 40 years ago this week, armed members of the Black Panther Party entered the California Assembly Chamber. A reporter who was there retells this remarkable story today on Insight. So today, our one-on-one talk with Governor Schwarzenegger. The focus is on healthcare reform, but we talk about the Republican candidates for president, too. Plus, a live interview from Shanghai, the Sacramento Ballet is on tour in China, and what Americans can learn from communicating with people from Thailand. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, our one-on-one talk with Governor Schwarzenegger. Also, we'll call Shanghai to find out how the opening performance went in the Sacramento Ballet's tour of China. Plus, lessons learned by a group of local college students who spent a year in Thailand. First, a remarkable thing happened in the California capital 40 years ago this week. On May 2, 1967, an armed group of Black Panthers entered the Assembly Chamber to protest a bill. No one was hurt. One of the reporters in the building that day was George Skelton, now a political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us. George Skelton, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How many armed men entered the Capitol that day?
That's a good question. You know, read a different news story and you get different reports. I say about six came into the Assembly Chamber itself. About 20 were outside. All the guys that came inside were armed, and most of the ones outside were armed, too. So it was about 25, 26, something like that.
And when you say armed, what were they carrying?
They're carrying rifles, shotguns. Some had just sidearms, pistols, revolvers. One guy had a military-style M14 with a big clip on it. Today you'd call that an assault weapon. He was in the assembly.
Now, there's an ironic element to the story. The reason why they were there is they were protesting a Republican gun control bill.
Correct.
Could you tell us about that?
Well, there was a guy by the name of Assemblyman Don Mulford from Piedmont, which, of course, is near Oakland, where the Black Panthers have been stirring up a lot of trouble. And Mulford decided that it should be illegal to carry a loaded gun on a street in California, or at least within on city streets, which today, you know, everybody would, yeah, what's wrong with that? That's a good idea. But the Panthers didn't like it, and Mulford was the Republican caucus chairman, so he carried the bill, maybe the last major gun control bill any Republican ever sponsored in Sacramento. But that's the irony of it. I talked to Willie Brown the other day. Willie Brown, who happened to be on the assembly floor that day, said today the Republicans would have been with the Panthers and with guns and defending the Panthers' right to have guns.
And this, of course, is Willie Brown, the future assembly speaker.
Future assembly speaker and future San Francisco mayor.
What did the Black Panther Party members with their guns do? Did they point them at people, or were they just carrying them loosely?
Well, what they did was they barged in, stormed through the doors, big old oak doors in the backs of the assembly chambers, and marched right up to the floor. It was only about 20 feet away, and then just stood there and did nothing and kind of looked around and, are we in the right place? One of the unwritten stories, and I haven't even written it, is that they apparently had wanted to go up to the gallery in the balcony and just sit there with their guns, but they took a wrong turn and wound up in the assembly chamber.
So they weren't really supposed to be in the chamber.
No, they wanted to be just looking down on everybody with their guns and have the high ground. They thought that would even be scarier. But there they are. They're standing there, and a lot of the legislators are diving for cover under desk, and some
of course
going out the side. And Willie, I guess, is, Willie Brown is standing near him, and according to one report, at least, says looks at him, and they look at him, and he had this short little afro haircut at the time, and he said, "I'm with you guys."
That's pretty smart. Did they make any speeches?
No, they made no speeches. The real hero was a guy who was the chief sergeant of arms named Tony Beard. He had been a four-sport athlete, lettered in four sports at USC. He was a big football star, track, swimming, baseball. And he's also a stuntman in Hollywood. Stuntman for the likes of John Wayne and Clark Gable. He was in Gone with the Wind. Anyway, he's a very fit guy, very good guy. And he came back and asked, "What are you guys doing here? We want to see our assembly members." "Well, this isn't the way to do it." "Well, how do you do it?" "Well, you go out that door and you stand behind the gate and I bring them out to you." So they did. He got them to go outside and stand behind the gate. And of course, he went in and nobody wanted to come out and talk to these guys. But I guess Willie did come out and talk to them. We found a picture of him talking to them. Then three old state cops showed up. In those days, state cops were way out of shape, and they had three, and they showed up and unloaded the weapons, and they got the Panthers stopped at the gas station on the way out of town and got arrested for having a loaded gun in the car. That was a violation of the Fish and Game Code.
But they weren't arrested for walking into the Capitol with these guns.
No, it was perfectly legal to do at the time. The legislature soon passed a bill making that illegal. They also passed the Mulford bill, making it illegal to carry an armed weapon in a city or in a public place, actually.
I've got to think there would be a very different reaction today if a group of armed men entered the state capitol.
They'd be swarmed on by the highway patrol today. The highway patrol polices the capitol, and there's a lot of sergeant of arms that are skilled in security. In fact, before you can become a sergeant at arms today, a deputy, you've got to go through a 16-week training academy. And today they'd be swarmed on. They got magnetometers all around the Capitol. You couldn't get near it. And you couldn't drive up there, of course, because there are big metal posts that ring the Capitol today.
And George Skelton, you were there at the time. Were you scared?
Yeah, I was scared. I mean, I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm a little bit scared. I'm a reporter, after all, so you got to be with a story. But yeah, I was on the floor in those days. Reporters could be on the floor. And I went back to see what the commotion was about. The presiding officer, you could hear the panic in his voice yelling, "Sergeant, remove those people. They don't have authority to be here." And of course, nobody was going near him. But Tony Beard did go back. But anyway, so I went back and I saw these guys standing there with guns. And I hunted a lot and I grew up with guns and I knew what could happen. Got a little jittery with your finger there, some sergeant decided to be a hero and take one of them out. You could have had a firefight, and it could have been a lot of people killed with ricocheted bullets, all kinds of things. So I knew what could happen with guns, and I was a little bit scared.
George Skelton, political columnist for the Los Angeles Times, he wrote about this remarkable day at the state capitol a couple of days ago in his paper, the LA Times. George, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, our one-on-one interview with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. This is Insight. Earlier this week, we went downtown to talk with California's governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Sitting in the governor's cabinet room, we focused on health care reform. Schwarzenegger has made that issue one of his top priorities this year. He's proposed a plan that would require everyone to get insurance and require insurance companies to offer everyone a plan. The total cost would be spread across the insured, the government, employers, doctors, and hospitals. Top lawmakers have health care reform plans, too. I started by asking the governor how he would define success in healthcare reform. What would legislation need for him to conclude that achieved something important?
I have made it very clear that in my State of the State that we want to reform the broken healthcare system, and we want to ensure everybody have mandatory insurance and also make sure that the insurance companies cover everybody, which means that no insurance company should be able to turn anyone away because of age or because of some medical history. That is the premise of the whole thing. When we have that, then we can eliminate all the other problems. But this is the key thing, what we want to shoot for. And there's many ways of going there and getting there. The legislative leaders, each one has a proposal on the table. Sheila Kuehl has a proposal on the table. We have our proposal on the table. So we want to put all of this together, the different proposals, and put that in a mix and then negotiate.
How important for you are private insurance companies in the healthcare industry?
I think that it is a very important factor because we don't believe that government ultimately should run healthcare because they've had their day. They're running the healthcare system for our prisons, and a federal judge had to take over. So that single payer idea or the government run program, to me, is not the area we want to go. We want to let the private market and the private sector take care of it because they can do it much better. But we want to set the guidelines and make the rules.
Supporters of the single payer system would say that if there were a single payer, it would remove the profit motive and it would remove multiple organizations making decisions.
Yeah, I totally understand in theory of what they try to accomplish. And we appreciate their thinking, coming up with different ways than what we have now to fix the problem. So this is all terrific. The only thing is we have not seen one run well. And we have our own, as I have said earlier, in our prison system where government runs it, and it's been disastrous. And there's 172,000 prisoners that are locked up. They cannot even go outside and shop around for a better deal. So we have locked up people. We have a captive audience right there, and they could not pull that off, and the federal judge has to take in. It's just that government is really not equipped to do those kind of things. And I think that we have seen it all over the world. This government programs don't work. People in places have to go and wait for a month to get surgery and to get medical attention. I mean, we have a plan, and ours will work. Where everyone is insured, have mandatory insurance, and have insurance companies cover everyone. And the other important thing with ours is that people, there should be shared responsibility, that everyone has to participate, if it is the hospitals, if it is doctors, employers, local government, state government, federal government, everyone has to participate, and then it can work.
Employers would still play an important part if your plan were to be enacted, but there are critics who say that connecting employment to health insurance is a problem in itself. Why not sever that link?
Well, because we know there's a lot of companies that right now cannot afford health care, and they want to provide health care for their workers. And there's other companies that are providing health care and discontinuing with their health care coverage because their health care costs are going up by double-digit numbers. As a matter of fact, we have met so many in these last few months, so many business leaders that have been telling us that their insurance has gone up and the healthcare costs have gone up by 25% a year. So this is the healthcare system in California is in a disastrous situation. It reminds me very much on a workers' comp situation, that when I came into office, that's one thing we reformed right away. And people were saying, why don't you do it this way, and why don't you take that approach, and we have tried it before, it didn't work, and we can't do that. And there was many, many reasons why we shouldn't have done it. But we did it. Democrats and Republicans came together, and we did it. And now, not only do we have the 25% drops in workers' comp costs, we have 50% drops in workers' comp costs, double. And we have an additional 16% drops this year. So this was a huge success. And basically with healthcare, we want to do the same thing.
I know there are millions of uninsured people in California. If everyone were to be insured under your plan, then someone's going to have to find an awful lot of money to pay the bills for those people. Where's that money going to come from?
Well, people are paying and buying the insurance. You know, we would have insurance policies that are $100, $150 that you can get right now, insurance policies that are $100. Then on top of that, we will have companies put 4% into the pot of the wages, and we will have hospitals put 4% in of their earnings. We will have doctors put in 2% of it. The federal government has already guaranteed to put $3.7 billion in matching funds in there. So we will create a pool, and out of that it will be paid. And what we want to do is we want to cover those that are, you know, people that can't afford health care, like, you know, people that are 250% poverty or below. So they will be taken care of. So we want to make sure that everyone gets covered and that everyone has a chance to also work on prevention, which right now no one is taking care of. If we have, if it's our program that we have recommend, that means that prevention will literally be free, that you can get your checkup so you don't get sick in the first place, because that's really where the action is, which is not a part of right now at all.
You mentioned the doctors and hospitals and how they would be contributing financially under your plan, but I know that there are doctors and hospitals who say, hey, we shouldn't be contributing to this system. Why should they?
We totally understand them saying that. You will never have everyone agree on anything. There is no such thing. What we want to do is we want to make sure that in the end, when the whole thing is done, when we have our healthcare system reformed, that everyone will pay less. That is the ultimate goal here. Everyone has to pay less. That means that the hospitals, for instance, or let's say, let's take hospitals, for instance. Right now, hospitals get stuck with unpaid bills because of the uninsured. There will be no such thing anymore. So they will benefit that everyone is insured and they get paid. Doctors will go, and those that are dealing with Medi-Cal patients will get now much more money, because now we will put $4 billion into the Medi-Cal system, and therefore doctors will finally get the money that they deserve, which is not, you know, 50 or 60 cents a dollar, but a dollar on a dollar. So, I mean, that those are the kind of things. So everyone will benefit from that. And one of the most important things that you have to remember is that right now we have 6.5 million people uninsured, and someone has to pay for those uninsured. And it is the insured people, you and me, we are paying for the uninsured people. So I don't think that's fair. So because all of our costs that we are paying for healthcare, it has a hidden tax. You don't even know it. If you pay your premiums, it is higher. You pay your co-pays, it's higher. Your deductibles are higher. Your out-of-pocket expenses are higher. If you go to the hospital, everything is higher. Everything is higher. The private sector, the businesses, are paying $14.7 billion in hidden tax. I came into this job to lower the taxes, not to increase the taxes. So we want to lower this $14.7 billion, and we want to lower that you pay and that I pay and everyone pays that is insured.
Your plan would require everyone to get health insurance and would require the health insurance companies to offer the insurance. But it, as I understand it, would not regulate the rates. How do you know that the insurance everyone must buy will be affordable?
Well, it will be affordable, first of all, because one of our provisions is that you insurance companies have to spend 85% of their earnings, of their income, on patient care, and only 15% for administrative costs and profits. So therefore, they cannot go and say, oh, this is really great. We are having mandatory insurance. Everyone has to have it. Now we're going to go and double our premiums. It won't happen, because 85% of the money goes to care. So therefore, they cannot drive up the price.
Earlier, you mentioned health care in the prison system, which has been taken over temporarily by a federal judge. On balance, has that been a good thing or a bad thing? Because they're spending a lot of money.
It's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because it shows the Californian people that a government-run healthcare system, for 172,000 prisoners, doesn't work. that a federal judge had to step in because it was a disaster. Why would we have the government run our healthcare system for 37 million people when they cannot even do it for 170,000 inmates? That is, it's very simple. So for that part, it is good. It's bad because we are basically competing against ourselves. So the judge that is running the healthcare system now, he appointed someone to take care of that. They're offering just twice as much money to doctors, and now doctors are leaving our prisons to go work for them. And so that is a chaos. So we are competing against ourselves. So we have to now increase the salaries in the hospitals. They increase the salaries, so we are competing against ourselves.
And finally, Governor, who do you like in the Republican race for president?
I think we have three good candidates there. It's Romney, it's McCain, and it's Giuliani. I think those three have proven themselves of being good leaders. And I don't endorse anyone at this point. I may not endorse anyone until after the convention. But I think that we have some interesting candidates there. And the Democrats also have some interesting candidates. But I'm very happy that those three candidates understand that the environment is important, that you got to be in California in the center. They understand that. And they are also, what is important is that they have to pay us more money when they become president, that California has to get more money. The 76 or the 79 cents on a dollar doesn't work. That's a commitment they have to make, any one of those guys, if they want to win here and if they want to get my endorsement.
And if you do endorse someone, is it certain to be a Republican?
Well, yeah, because I would say, as I said, I'm very happy with who we have in the Republican Party. It's now just a question of listening to some of their ideas, and especially those ideas that are very important for California. If it is how much money we get, if it is environmental issues, if it is getting more, becoming more independent of fossil fuel, if it is infrastructure, healthcare, immigration, those are very important issues to California people, and we want to hear the answers.
Governor Schwarzenegger, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And that interview with Governor Schwarzenegger was recorded on Wednesday afternoon in the governor's cabinet room. You could hear the clock ringing 5 o'clock in the background just at the end. You can see pictures from that interview at capradio.org/insight. The next day, Schwarzenegger went to Simi Valley for an event featuring 10 Republicans running for president. Afterwards, there was no report of the governor publicly saying that he favored any of those candidates. Coming up, lessons learned by a group of local college students who spent a year in Thailand. We'll be right back. To Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Four Sacramento State students recently returned from a year of living and working in Thailand. They were assisting in the English language program at the Thai Royal Palace School in Bangkok. Another group of Sac State students will head to Thailand soon. The organizer of this program is Communication Studies Professor Thomas Knudsen. He recently won the 2007 Award for Outstanding Contributions to International Education from Phi Beta Delta, the Honor Society for International Scholars. Knudsen has visited Thailand nearly three dozen times and is an expert on intercultural communication. He and one of the students who recently returned from Thailand are in our studio. Thomas Knudsen and Casey Mayville, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Thomas, how did it come about that the students taught English at Thailand's Royal Palace School? It sure sounds more glamorous than teaching at Berlitz.
Well, it is a remarkable place. We were able to make connections with Jeffrey Hattersley, who is the headmaster at Chitraladha and the former speechwriter for Margaret Thatcher. And we expressed to him that we have some excellent students at Sacramento State that could help him out. And he believed us, and Casey and the other students delivered in a very successful way.
Casey, how was it teaching there?
Well, I don't really know where to begin. It was definitely a memorable experience. the students, the teachers, I think Thai people in general made it worthwhile and were the most kind and accommodating and hospitable people I could imagine.
Who were you teaching?
I was actually teaching first grade, and so they were about 6 years old, spoke no English, and it made the first day of class pretty interesting, but they were just so endearing. I'll never forget them, ever.
Who exactly were these children that they were being taught at the Royal Palace School?
Some of them had connections with the king or the royal family, their parents. Some of them were just, you know, their parents were either worked for the king or worked for, some of them worked for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So some of the upper class of Thailand, definitely.
Well, how did you approach day one with these young children who didn't speak English?
Well, I had my lesson plan written out, but nothing really turned out as I had hoped. So I ended up drawing a lot of pictures on the board with my marker, and I made a lot of hand gestures. We sang some songs and kind of just established a routine that I could in the future use, usually starting off with the song and learning their names. That was quite a feat in itself. Their names are very long. So,
and by the end of the year, what kind of English did they know?
Pretty basic still, mostly just vocabulary, a few sentences such as how are you, and learning to say I am fine. They could say colors, numbers, the alphabet, clothing, animals. So mostly just vocabulary, not a whole lot of grammar yet.
Now, a lot of us have memories of giving a hard time to guest teachers, to student teachers. How were you received?
Well, at first they didn't really know how to approach me. Many of them have never had a foreign teacher before. So just hearing me speak English with, you know, an American accent was different for them. They were shy at first. And then, you know, we established a relationship and they were really, really loving and affectionate, and you know, that we still had some class clowns and some mischievous ones, but for the most part they were great, all of them.
Casey Mayville, Sacramento State student, spent about a year in Thailand, in Bangkok to be precise, where she was teaching English to young children. And Thomas Knudsen is the professor at Sacramento State who organized this. I guess there was some kind of program to prepare these students like Casey to go out there. This is a big deal what they were doing.
Right. One of the successes, I think, for any intercultural sojourner is pre-departure training. And Professor Richard Adams, also a Thai veteran, I guess we're called old Asia hands these days, and I put together a pre-departure program. In fact, we just finished one last weekend for our four students headed there. And that works quite well because the Thais are quite impressed with the Sacramento State students' knowledge of Thailand and Thai culture.
Casey, tell us a bit more about the people of Thailand.
Oh, where to begin? They are the nicest people I think I've met in general. They smile all the time. They take a little while to become their friend, but after that, they are definitely lifelong friends. I can't wait to go back. I think the people really make the country, you know, worth visiting, definitely.
Well, Thomas, you've been there 34 times now. Is Casey's experience of the people of Thailand representative of the country?
I wasn't with Casey all of the time, but it's certainly representative of mine. Jeffrey, I've been in 42 countries, and I don't want to go anyplace else. Thailand is absolutely remarkable. The number one cultural value in Thailand is social harmony. And someone once described Bangkok as Hong Kong on Valium. The people are just genuinely pleasant. And you may have heard that Thailand is called the Land of Smile. And that's not just a tourist slogan. It's genuinely so. Thai people are nice folks.
Why are they so nice? How do they do it?
Well, I could go into a long theoretical description. they're a collective, high-context culture.
What do you mean?
Well, they're very receiver-oriented in their communication. They are a we kind of culture compared to our I kind of culture. And you can see the difference in culture by saying that, number one, we have our cultural value is, number one, is achievement as measured by material things. And that stands in stark contrast to Thailand's number one cultural value, which is social harmony. And that's judged in terms of the relationships you have with people.
Are there any downsides to that? I mean, it sounds very nice, but I guess there's always two sides to every coin.
Well, yes, it's the that Bangkok has the worst traffic, the lousiest weather, the worst pollution imaginable, but that's not why folks go there. Folks go there because of the incredible and Thai hospitality and spirit.
Casey, did you change the way you related to people as you spent month after month there?
Yes, I think I was definitely more flexible when it comes to planning day-to-day activities. Thai people, they just kind of go with where the day takes them. And there'll be many times I've prepared a lesson plan and activities, and they say, okay, no class today. Today will be tree day. And it will be, you know, just some event that they've thought up. And I think my flexibility just in day-to-day activities was better, and also my patience, and finding out that a smile goes a long way there. And if you are nice about things, and they are usually pretty accommodating.
Did you find yourself smiling more as you spent more time there?
I think so. I think that if I couldn't understand someone or didn't really know the answer to something, a smile was always a great filler.
Thomas, did you choose the people who went, or did they select themselves?
The Sacramento State students?
Yes.
No, we have a competition. Mm. And then Professor Adams and I looked at the people, and we interviewed them and so on, and then sent forward our recommendations to Chitraladha, and they made the final selection with the endorsement of Her Majesty the Princess.
Did you want to see Sac State students who are easygoing, smiling, pleasant kind of people to go there because they would get on more easily with the Thai people?
Actually, the prime criterion was intelligence, grade point, and ability to explain complex issues to people. Thais are quite accepting of anything, and we didn't think that our students would have trouble adjusting. But we were concerned that the students from America behave in a fashion accommodating Thai culture rather than saying, here I am, I'm from America, I'm here to tell you the truth.
Casey, what did Thai people of your age group think about America and Americans? And did you fit in with their image, their image of Americans?
Yes, I think so. I think whenever I mentioned I'm from California, you know, they have the idea of movie stars and people they see in movies and magazines and on TV. So yes, I think so. They, even my Thai friend, he put on his new clothes and his new jeans, and he said, yes, now I look like Justin Timberlake. Yeah. I said, you sure do. So, I mean, our media and our cultural norms have a big impact on their culture as well.
What about free speech? In a culture that is very we oriented and reception oriented, how do they view the great American interest and defense of free speech?
That's a difficult issue. In Thailand, there is free speech. However, the libel is a criminal offense there, and sometimes that's used by the government to control the press and control the media. The average Thai on the street, however, is quite open and free to say whatever he or she does, providing it doesn't harm other people. There's a phrase in the Thai language. There are a lot of jai words. J-A-I means heart. And one of the major rules in Thailand is kreng jai. And that means you don't impose yourself on other people. You don't bother other people. So to that extent, they tend to be less willing to communicate and a bit more circumspect than we do. But in terms of freedom of speech on the street, it's virtually wide open.
And what do they think of America's interest in individualism?
Well, I think if the truth be known, Thais are prone to see people outside their borders as barbaric. But that is never said to the face of someone. Thais will be quietly amused by our loud antics and direct communication.
We have a little clip of music to play, and Thomas, this was recorded in our studios last year. It was a group of doctoral students from Thailand that you brought over from
Kasetsart University. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about them in a moment, but let's hear a clip of the song that they performed. And a charming group of people. What's the song about?
Well, it's a love song and an expression of friendship and appreciation for being invited to the radio station.
Well, I don't think they realized it'd be played again many months later.
Nor did I. That was quite a pleasant surprise.
Now, wasn't there a military coup in Thailand last year?
Yes, there
was. That must have complicated things a little bit.
Actually, no. Thais are quite experienced with coups. this was not a blood or a violent coup. In fact, one of my Thai friends said it best. He said it was more of a coup de grace than a coup d'état.
Still, you must have thought, uh-oh, when you heard first that there'd been something happening.
We did, and our students from Kasetsart University in Thailand were here. And actually, we found out about it through a cell phone call during class. And of course, we were concerned about Casey and the rest of the students, but there was no alarm. There was a military presence in the streets, but the tanks had flowers, and people were just happy to change the government.
Casey, what did you and the other Sacramento State students make of the coup when it happened?
Well, it did come as a surprise. We didn't really know what to expect, but we got a phone call from the school, the director, at about 5 in the morning. But prior to that, I had received an email from a friend in America at about 11 o'clock my time, and he said, "Are you okay? I don't know what's going on." And I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "Oh, there's been a military takeover." And I thought, well, I don't know what to think. And I went to bed. I don't have a TV, or I didn't have a TV in my room, so I didn't watch the news and sometimes check the news online. But went to bed, received the phone call, and said, "Please don't come to school today. It will be canceled. There's been a military takeover. Please don't panic, but try to stay inside and stay close to home." And I thought, well, okay, no school. So we went to the rest of the teachers and I, about 10 of us, went to breakfast and kind of discussed it, and didn't notice any difference out and about. But later on, we did see tanks and soldiers with, guns, and people had this idea, and I think CNN and some of the other online news channels made it seem like it was worse than it actually was. But these tanks weren't roaming the streets and running people over. They had yellow ribbons and they had flowers, and people were getting their pictures taken in front of them. And, so we didn't notice a big change in our daily lives.
What was it like fitting back into life here in California?
Oh, it was adjustment. I came from a very big city, living in Bangkok, right in the middle of town. And so coming back here, it did seem very quiet. I live actually up in Placerville, so it is very quiet up there and serene, and the fresh air was nice. But I still think about it just about every day and really can't wait to go back.
And Thomas Knudsen, finally, what's the main thing that you see students getting out of this kind of experience?
I think they come back home with a greater appreciation of civility, among other things. We're living, I think, in an age of incivility in the United States, where customer service is gone forever and people are reluctant to say thank you and please. And people who come back from Thailand recognize the genuine appreciation of their fellow human beings, and I think that's probably the biggest gift.
Well, thank you both very much. That was Thomas Knudsen, Communication Studies Professor at Sacramento State, and Casey Mayville, Sacramento State student who recently returned from about a year in Thailand, where she assisted in the English language program at the Thai Royal Palace School in Bangkok, that program organized by Thomas. Thank you both.
Thank you for inviting us.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we return to Asia. We'll call Shanghai to find out how the opening performance went in the Sacramento Ballet's Tour of China. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The Sacramento Ballet is in China. Friday night, that's last night if you're on the east coast of China, was the company's first show. They performed at the Majestic Theater in Shanghai. To tell us how things are going there, Sacramento Ballet Artistic Director Ron Cunningham joins us by phone from his hotel room in Shanghai, where it's rather early on Saturday morning. Ron, thanks so much for joining us at this time.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks. Thanks for having me on air.
Well, so the first performance was last night, your time. How did it go?
It went fantastic. It could not have gone better. It was a shared performance, performing along with our dancers, Sacramento Ballet dancers. We had the Shanghai Ballet and the students, the graduating students from the famous Shanghai Ballet School. So we shared the program together, and it was just a wonderful collaboration.
How long did everyone stay up afterwards? It must have been so exciting to be there.
It was pretty exciting. You know, we're traveling with what we're calling a VIP guest. We're traveling with about 35 Sacramentans who are big Sacramento Ballet fans who've come along with us. And we had a big celebration last night, a big dinner with lots of toasts. And I guess we were up to really about 12 or so. And today we have our second performance, so we'll be working hard again today.
And just so our listeners know, what time is it right now for you in Shanghai?
Right now it is a quarter to six a.m. On Saturday. So, yes. we're a day ahead of Sacramento, which is always a weird experience traveling to China where you cross the international date line. You get a little discombobulated with the time.
Now, as emissaries of a sort from the United States, is there an American theme to some or all of the dances you're doing?
Well, yes. In fact, we're not just an emissary from the United States. We're emissaries from the city of Sacramento. And we exchanged gifts last night with some of the dignitaries of Shanghai. Mayor Fargo gave us some gifts to give some the cultural ministers, and we exchanged gifts on stage. And I'm sorry, you asked me a question. I don't think I answered it.
And now I can't
what
remember.
Did we do that was particularly American?
Yes, that's right.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, the curtain came up, and the first ballet we did was the first movement of Western Symphony, George Balanchine's wonderful Western Symphony. So the first glimpse they got of Sacramento Ballet dancers was the cowboys and saloon girls. And I'm not sure they knew what to make of that, because they normally think of ballet as much more classical here. We got a good start with Western Symphony, they seem to enjoy that very much. And then the Shanghai Ballet dancers did some more traditional ballets, more what people expect from ballet. And we concluded the last night's program with Wild Sweet Love, which we had just premiered in Sacramento last season. And it was a huge success. I think that was a big hit of the evening. The audience really, really enjoyed it.
Ron Cunningham is Artistic Director of the Sacramento Ballet. The company is touring China. Right now they're in Shanghai. Last night, that's Friday night, they had the first performance of their tour. Now, you danced in China 27 years ago.
That's right.
And go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
We danced with the Boston Ballet in 70s and 80s. We danced with the Boston Ballet. And we were the first American, Boston Ballet, was the first American ballet company to be invited to China. And it happened to be my choreography of Cinderella that got us on that tour. And my wife, of course, was Cinderella. So she danced the role of Cinderella. And I was an ugly stepsister as well at that very same theater, the Majestic Theater. So for us, it was like a homecoming of sorts and kind of nostalgic to bring our own company here.
Is this coincidence that you and your wife are taking the ballet to the same theater as you were at 27 years ago? Or did you make contacts then that you're making use of today?
Well, many people who saw us in 1980 remember us. In fact, the director of the Shanghai Ballet School was a very renowned dancer who now directs the school. He was a graduating student of the Shanghai Ballet when we performed, and he remembered seeing us perform at that time. So there is kind of a connection in that way. But it had always been our dream, Karine and I, to bring our own company to China and let them have the same experience that we had so many years ago. So it's always kind of been in the back of our mind. And we started putting some things in motion several years ago to bring this to fruition. I wouldn't say it was direct contact with people that we had organized back in 1980. It was a little bit different.
How would you compare Shanghai today with the Shanghai you saw 27 years ago?
Oh, my goodness. The difference is phenomenal. Today, Shanghai is probably one of the most sophisticated cities in the world. I think there are more. In fact, I heard that someplace yesterday, someone remarked that Shanghai has more skyscrapers than any city in the world, and I certainly believe it. You can be in a taxi cab on one of the highways, traveling at, up to speed for an hour practically, and never run out of skyscrapers. I've never seen so many. Mm. And the development of the city is just phenomenal, and it's very classy and sophisticated and colorful. And back in 1980, it was a very different thing. There were really no skyscrapers, and the only tall buildings were what's called the Bund. It was the old European concession along the river. You know, they're like 7-8-story buildings. Those were the tallest buildings at the time. And in those days, everybody dressed the same, rather drab colors, and no one owned cars, just government cars, and just millions of black bicycles in the street. And many people had never seen Westerners before. And in those days, my hair was still blonde. Now it's white, of course. But in those days, it was still blonde. And I don't think they'd ever seen blonde, blue-eyed people before. They looked at us like we were from Mars. And today, of course, Westerners are very, very common. You see Westerners everywhere in Shanghai. So it's very different.
Yes. Now, it's a very long journey. You and the dancers traveled for more than 24 hours, and obviously there's going to be jet lag because of the time zone difference. How do you keep these young dancers in physical and mental and emotional shape to do these big, high-profile performances?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said young dancers. Young is the key. Their bodies are very resilient. They're used to the training. They're used to the rigors of physicality. So while it is a hard trip, when they got here, actually the first day after they arrived, the dancers arrived quite late at night. They didn't really get to their hotel rooms until about midnight, the first on their arrival. The next day, we went to the Shanghai Ballet School in the afternoon. I spent the day in the theater organizing technical things.
Hello? Do we have Ron Cunningham? Sounds like we lost Ron Cunningham. Well,
please enter the phone number.
Obviously we don't have Ron Cunningham. As it happens, we're just about at the end of the show. If we can get him back for a second or two, then we will. But otherwise, we'll be wrapping up. That's Ron Cunningham, Artistic Director of the Sacramento Ballet. The company is touring Shanghai. They're in Shanghai. We were talking with Ron Cunningham from his hotel room in Shanghai, where it's early on Saturday morning. They just did the first performance. There are two more shows, one on Saturday and one on Wednesday. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. I don't know if we'll get Ron Cunningham again at this point. So we will wrap up the show for today and for this week. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. While there, you'll see a link to a blog. It's written by Jay Mather, who's a former photographer at the Sacramento Bee. He's accompanying the Sacramento Ballet. He's writing a blog, and he's got some amazing photographs from the ballet's tour of China. So you can get a link to that at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the ships that carried the Jamestown settlers across the Atlantic included one particular group of passengers, teenage boys. They were to be left with the native population to learn the local language. That story and the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producers were Robin Souza and Lourdes Munoz. Also, significant help from KXJZ's Capital Bureau reporters Jenny O'Mara and Marianne Russ. Insight's theme is composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Assistant producer is Natalie Breen. And the senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. Next Insight, learn how dogs and cats help kids in Sacramento's Juvenile Hall. You'll find out about Lend a Heart, a local charity that brings pets to people in need. Also, how the Sacramento Bee gives the public a say in what makes the front page. Plus, find out what trends are okay to wear at the office this summer. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.